Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drower, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss Gonzales v. Google LLC, which was argued before the court on February 21st. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Eric Jaffe, who's a partner at Cher Jaffe LLP. He has been involved in over 120 Supreme Court matters and clerked in the past for Justice Clarence Thomas. With that introduction, I'll hand things over to Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. Always happy to come chat and talk about new cases that are up at the court, particularly ones that I follow and I'm interested in. It's interesting. This case will be interesting. So for those of you joining up, I assume you all are roughly familiar with what the issues in the case are. But at the end of the day, the primary question is whether or not making targeted recommendations via algorithm or otherwise of content somehow loses immunity under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And Section 230, the relevant part, provides that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So the question is whether making a recommendation of somebody else's, in this case, video, somehow loses you immunity under 230 for a claim that says your recommendations meant people joined ISIS and killed my relatives. And so does recommending third-party content somehow trigger liability that is different than if you had republished or spoke the, you know, just posted the third-party content without a recommendation? This is a statutory question about the scope of statutory protections. It doesn't ask whether the Constitution covers this. It doesn't ask what would happen if Section 230 immunity didn't exist. But I think there are a whole bunch of lurking free speech issues underneath this, these questions that make it interesting. And I'll get to some of those at the back end, but let me sort of summarize what happened at the argument. So the argument order at the courthouse was counsel for Mr. Gonzales, who was arguing that 230 does not apply to a suit that alleged material support for ISIS by having put their videos in the up next category as a thumbnail. And then it was followed by a counsel for the United States who argued that he didn't think 230 necessarily applied here, though he did think that there was no decent claim. But at the end of the day, he was sort of somewhere in the middle, but generally hostile to the notion that 230 would necessarily cover this. And then finally, counsel for Google, who, of course, argued that 230 does cover this. And the questioning started out for counsel for Gonzales, Mr. Schnapper, with Justice Thomas, who I think many had been concerned, was skeptical of Section 230, and might look for ways to narrow it. And in fact, his questions suggested almost the opposite, that he was quite skeptical of the claims that merely popping a video up in the up next category based on an algorithm that said, you seem to like ISIS videos, here's an ISIS video, or you searched for an ISIS video, here's another one. He seemed extremely skeptical that that could lose 230 protections for, in this case, YouTube, whose parent is Google. It was just interesting. He sort of, his questioning focused on whether or not the algorithm was neutral as to the content, i.e. it treated cat videos in much the same way that it treated ISIS videos or, you know, cooking videos, or whether you like Turkish kebabs and Turkish rice pilaf, I think was his example. And I think that's a fair way to look at it. He sort of said, look, if the answer is you seem to like cat videos or rice pilaf videos, here's another one. Why is it different when it's ISIS? In terms of you're not recommending it, you're just acknowledging what the user of YouTube seems to want. And that seemed to be a recurring theme of his questions, where he just sort of didn't see how it was that giving people stuff that was responsive to their past behavior or their requests could somehow make you liable for the fact that they were watching these things. And so that was quite encouraging from someone from my perspective. And fair warning, I had a brief in this case in support of Google. I think Section 230 would protect the particular behavior in this case. My firm had another brief in the case on behalf of a group called Protect the First, and on behalf of former Senator Santorum, again, arguing that Section 230 applied and generally would protect stuff like this. Again, a pro-speech kind of approach. But that being said, I was quite pleased to see Justice Thomas surprise some observers by coming out seemingly in favor of a reasonably robust application of Section 230. Other justices, I think on balance, all the justices, in my view, came out fairly pro-230 in this instance and sort of were more skeptical of Gonzalez's arguments than they were of Google's, with a few notable exceptions. In no particular order other than as I sort of wrote down the questions and my observations, so not in order of seniority, I thought the next set of interesting questions came from Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who I think was a little more in the middle on what she thought the scope of 230 was. At least certainly at the beginning, she seemed a little more sympathetic to Gonzalez's arguments and was trying to find a line between, are you simply displaying it through some sort of ordinary criteria for displaying things, you have to make a choice, or are you encouraging some particular content? At the end of the day, you know, it struck me that she was perhaps driving towards this notion of endorsement as opposed to display. So it's one thing to sort of say, I need to pop something up top, so I'm going to use a bunch of criteria. Does it meet your previous searches? Is it something I think you're interested in? Is it something people like you seem to be interested in? Is it the most popular thing on the web these days? So I'm going to pop that up to the top of your scroll of possible videos, versus, am I sending it to you because I think I agree with it? And I thought at the end of the day, after a lot of questions from her, there were some hints that that may be the line she's drawing. And that's not a crazy line at all. It's actually a line that to some degree, I think counsel for Google and even my amicus brief sort of adopted, which said, you got to ask, are you being held for your content or someone else's content? And if the answer is, yeah, ISIS made the video, but I said, hey, this is a great video, they got it exactly right, I sort of adopted their content as my own, and then I'm being held for my own speech and my own information content. And I think she might have been pushing a little bit on that line, but didn't quite get there. But again, I thought she was skeptical. And one of the indicia of her skepticism about this, or her at least uncertainty about how to properly resolve the case, was she kept asking, well, what happens if tomorrow I decide there's no cause of action here? So just for those keeping track, there's another case involving similar issues involving Twitter, where the question is, does this anti-support for terrorists statute, I forget what it's called, JASTA is the acronym, but I forget the exact title, but there's a statute under which this lawsuit was brought that says you're materially supporting ISIS. And the question is, does posting their videos constitute aiding and abetting ISIS? And so Justice Barrett said, well, what if I decide that the aiding and abetting doesn't reach that far? Do I need to reach the 230 issue, or can I just, I presumably, dismiss as improvidently granted or remand it with instructions to kick the case out because there's no cause of action regardless of what Section 230 says? And to me, that signaled that she finds the 230 issue sufficiently difficult or problematic as to want to find another way to kick the case out. And she at least kept asking the attorneys this question: can I throw it away if I decide tomorrow's case against the sort of the plaintiffs? And pretty much no one said yes to that question. The answer uniformly was no to whenever she would ask that question. Invariably, they would say something to the effect of, well, you got to give us a chance to replead, or there wasn't a motion to dismiss, but you need to decide the 230 question first. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think they're going to sort of kick it out, but it certainly was an indicia that she's on the fence on this stuff. The next justice of interest, or at least in order of how I wrote things down, was Justice Sotomayor, who I think once again was quite skeptical of the attempt to restrict Section 230 to not cover this kind of thing. And again, she was especially concerned with the interaction between the immunity and the liability aspects, whether aiding and abetting could be found in what was otherwise protected under 230. But ultimately, separating out the is there a cause of action versus is there immunity, I think she, at the end of the day, was very skeptical that any sort of recommendation can suddenly make you liable for the content being recommended, regardless of the basis of your recommendation. So if the basis of your recommendation was, this seems to be the most popular answer in the world, so I'm going to give it to you first, and that's my recommendation, that's my prioritization, she seemed to be skeptical that that somehow meant you had done something worthy of losing immunity. Asked a lot of questions to that effect, again, over and over, sort of pressing upon counsel for Gonzalez in a way that I thought suggested she wasn't very sympathetic to counsel's arguments. The next one was the Chief Justice, again, also skeptical, lots of questions about, how does this, every website seems to work this way. Are you saying that every time we put something first, that's a recommendation? And also, I thought, quite interestingly, worried about the economic ramifications of this, that if these sort of organizational principles of we're going to feed you those things that seem most relevant to you, if we suddenly are going to hold people liable for those organizing choices, that would apply to everyone, everywhere, every search engine, every website, every moderator, and would have massive economic effects and would be massively disruptive to the internet. And he sort of felt like the court should not be the one choosing to have such a disruptive effect, that was a choice that Congress had to decide and had to balance disruption versus greater or lesser protection, et cetera. So again, quite encouraging, very, very in keeping, by the way, with Justice Roberts's sort of approach to the world, which is sort of don't blow up the system if there's another way out. And here we have a pretty consistent set of decisions by lower courts that say this is protected. And if Congress doesn't like them, Congress can change it. And they seem to be on the ball about noticing this. So let them do it. Don't have the court step in and make such a massive and disruptive claim. And I thought that was quite in keeping with his general modus operandi of don't have the court become the agent of disruption if it doesn't have to. Sometimes it has to, sometimes it doesn't. But here you could see the more natural conservative tendencies showing through. Justice Kagan similarly seemed a little skeptical, though I thought explored some interesting questions about what is the nature of the algorithm? What is the nature of the recommendation? Is the recommendation one that simply says, you seem to like cats, here's more cats. You seem to like ISIS, here's more ISIS. Or was it, golly gee, we really like ISIS and we think you should watch ISIS because we like ISIS. So it's sort of a viewpoint driven or content driven recommendation that has an implied message. The message being, you should watch more ISIS because ISIS is good versus you should watch more ISIS because you seem to like ISIS. That, you know, one is one's own speech. The other is merely an editing function, or at best a statement that says, we want you to watch more videos on our thing. We don't care what they are. So we're just going to show you videos that you seem to like. So again, I thought she was pretty good. Justice Kavanaugh, again, extremely cautious, again, in the line of sort of Chief Justice Roberts, again, concerned about economic disruption and, you know, all the disruptive effects of this, leaving it to Congress. I thought he, again, was quite strong in terms of having a broadish reading of 230 that wouldn't allow liability simply because you suggested the content that somebody else created, particularly where the harm from that suggestion is people watch the content and the content made them do bad stuff. Again, I thought he was quite good. Justice Alito, similarly quite good on the pro 230 side of the fence. Again, quite skeptical of where you would draw the line. Counsel for Gonzalez was having a very, very hard time making a coherent distinction about where you would draw the line. And I'll get to that in a few minutes, but he sort of tried to draw a distinction between, well, you showed them a thumbnail, which you created, and so you can be liable for that. But if you had just popped up the video directly, that's okay. Versus, well, they asked for the video, sure, you showed them the video, so that's not on you. But if they ask for the video and you show them that video plus one other that's like it, that is on you. He was having an incredibly difficult time drawing a very thin line that ultimately very few of the justices thought made any sense. And even his erstwhile allies in the United States didn't think his lines made much sense. And I confess, I agree with them. So then we get to the last two justices, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And I think there we finally get a little more skepticism of on the 230 side of the fence. Justice Gorsuch was skeptical only in the sense that he was looking for a way to get a remand without having to necessarily give the final answer. But I thought the way he approached Section 230 was interesting, and I sort of agree with him. To him, the question was, where is the line between being responsible for your own conduct or your own information content versus being held responsible for a third party's information content? And he looked to some definitions in the statute, again, definitions that I fully agree with, that we sort of pointed out in our amicus brief, where he said, look, information content, information service providers, they pick, they choose, they digest, they analyze, they prioritize, they do all these things to other people's content that doesn't make those things their own content. Otherwise, the statute would be largely meaningless. And I agree with him with that. That those things seem to be the functions of information of service providers that they're supposed to be allowed to do rather than be responsible and liable for. That's what gets them, triggers the option of immunity. It doesn't detract from it. But he sort of thought that the real question then is, does YouTube's algorithmic recommendations somehow convert the content, the information content provided by ISIS or by any third party, into YouTube's own information content? And to my mind, what he was driving at is, did you endorse the content? Did you adopt the content? Did you say, yes, this content is right and you should watch it? And I think that's the kind of line he was probably drawing, though we didn't get that far down the chain because he was participating by telephone, it sounded like. So it was a little more difficult for him to follow up on things, I thought. But he kept on looking for, can I just remand to the Ninth Circuit and tell them focus on content rather than focus on what he described as the neutral tools? And I think that's interesting. I'm not sure he's completely accurate in what he thinks the Ninth Circuit did below in their reference to neutral tools. But the Ninth Circuit sort of had a couple passing references to, well, if the choices are being made by neutral tools, then you can't say that they've adopted it as their own. And I think that's right, but I think there was a little bit of confusion about what neutral tools means in this context. Obviously, an AI or a computer algorithm theoretically is neutral, though that really sort of depends on how you programmed it. I suppose if you programmed it to be viewpoint discriminatory or content discriminatory, then it's not that neutral. It's either pro-content or anti-content or pro-viewpoint or anti-viewpoint. And those algorithmic elements may help decide whether you're adopting the republished content as your own, or those algorithmic elements may be neutral as to the content, but non-neutral as to other things like, yes, we want people to watch us more, so we're going to give them more that they seem to like. That's not neutral. It's not random or arbitrary. It has a view. It has an intent, and the intent is simply to give you more of what you want, but it doesn't care what you want. So it's neutral as to the viewpoint, but it's not neutral necessarily as to, yes, you should keep using my service. Finally, Justice Jackson was absolutely the most skeptical of the Google position here, basically taking a position that Section 230 was adopted for a very narrow purpose of letting people remove trash from their websites and not be held liable for the trash they missed. So she sort of looks at the interaction between C1 and C2 of Section 230 and says, C1 says you can't be held liable for other people's content. C2 says, and we're not going to hold you liable for removing unpleasant content, you know, libel, slander, offensive content. You know, you get to have some editorial discretion on taking junk down so that the internet is not a complete sewer if you're inclined to help make it not a sewer, or at least so that your web service is not a sewer, but that we don't want you to be liable for taking some stuff down but missing other stuff. And she had this very narrow view of the original purpose of 230 that got a lot of pushback, but would probably not protect Google in this case. So of all the justices, she was the one that seemed most sympathetic to Gonzalez's position. I thought Justice Barrett and Justice Gorsuch were not quite sympathetic to Gonzalez's position, but less willing to go all on board with Google and perhaps get a remand or a dig. And so that was sort of interesting. But I, at least by my sort of intuitive spidey sense, I see 6 votes that sort of says, you know, the theory of the case presented by Gonzalez here, that popping up a thumbnail and says, you seem to like ISIS, here's more ISIS, is not enough to lose 230 liability. That's my gut sensation. I could easily see that being 7-2 or 8-1. I can see that being 8-1 on, well, I can see Justice Barrett and Justice Gorsuch writing a concurrence or two that sort of says, I think we should dig this, but at the end of the day, whatever, this is okay, maybe concurring in the judgment. Whether Justice Jackson writes a dissent or not, I don't know. She might write a concurrence for other reasons, but have a narrower interpretation of 230 that lets her, you know, deal with other cases in the future in a slightly different way. So we'll see. So that's where I think the justices are at. Let's talk a little bit about where I thought the lawyers were at. Going back to counsel for Gonzalez, I thought they chose a line that was incredibly difficult to defend. The line they chose, it seems to me, well, there was a theoretical okayness to it, but it just didn't apply to their case very well. So they chose to say that when you create a thumbnail of a video, which is basically a picture with a link in it to a video that somebody else has uploaded to your site, that is somehow your content and you are now responsible for that content. So if you recall when I read Section 230 to y'all a few minutes ago, or more than a few minutes ago, it said, you can't be held liable as the publisher of the information content provided by another. And the way he's trying to get out of this is by saying, well, the thumbnail isn't information content provided by another. It's information content that you created, or at least co-created, and hence you can be held liable for that. And, you know, pardon my bluntness, but that distinction, the distinction between your information content and their information content is fine. The distinction between I put a thumbnail up versus I just played the video versus I had a static screenshot of their video that didn't have a hyperlink in it, that distinction is idiotic. And look, you know, he's a good lawyer. I'm sure he had to go back and forth and had a lot of help at moot courts on figuring out this line. But that line is indefensible. the notion that there is a difference between a hyperlink and a screenshot and a thumbnail is incoherent within the context of 230, just incoherent. And so that really got him in a bunch of trouble, and tons of people were skeptical about that. And it's going to go nowhere. It's going to go absolutely nowhere. The real question will be, what was the basis for the algorithm, not what was the format in which the results were displayed, whether they were displayed as a video that you asked for, whether they were displayed as a thumbnail, or whether they were displayed as a static screenshot. That's not going to be the line. The other thing he sort of said that was interesting, he said, look, the injury to his clients was not from the ISIS content. It was from the fact that you put the thumbnails up there and then people watched it because of the thumbnails. And I don't know that, again, there's a thin line there which says, well, they were injured because people watched the underlying video and then liked ISIS, gave money to ISIS, supported ISIS in some way. But the injury was really only from your recommendation, not from the underlying video. Or somehow your recommendation marginally changed the injury of them having watched the video themselves merely because they got more people to watch it. Again, I think that line is largely indefensible and is not going to be something that people rely on, because at the end of the day, if your algorithm simply said, pop up the most commonly requested answer and it happened to be the ISIS video, yes, more people would watch it. Again, that is not... you're still trying to hold them liable based on the content of the video. If the content of the video was cats, even if it said ISIS on the cover, but the content was cats, then there would be no harm here, right? Nothing would have happened. They said a few other things that I thought were interesting. He tried to make the argument that YouTube sort of fed you these videos before you even asked it to. So it's a sort of distinction between reactive versus proactive feeding you of content. I'm not sure that distinction holds up, but I thought it was at least more interesting. He said, look, if they sent you an email that said, by the way, there's some ISIS content we think you might like, that might be somehow different than if you got on there and said, oh, I'd like some ISIS videos, and they showed you one and said, here's a bunch of others, that was somehow different. Again, I think it's a little bit thin distinction. It didn't sort of work for me, but it was less incoherent, at least. There was at least a line of affirmative versus responsive feeding you of information, as suggesting whose content it really was that you're being held liable for. The final two things that he said that were interesting was, one, he tried to limit the damage here because the statute that holds you responsible for aiding and abetting terrorism includes recommending terroristic content. And so that this wouldn't be true of most other courts like defamation. I don't know if that's true or not true, but it was an interesting attempt to narrow this, to make this a very narrow scenario that likely would not happen elsewhere. I thought the other advocates helped make clear that that's probably not the case, that there are lots of courts of negligence that could just sort of say, well, you negligently let them see more videos about anorexia or cutting or suicide or any of the things that people say you shouldn't let people watch. And so I'm not sure he's right that JASTA, the statute, is that unique vis-a-vis other sort of torts out there. And then the last thing he said, there was a discussion about whether if the definition of an information content or an information service provider, so the triggering entities that are covered by 230, if that definition includes folks who engage in selecting, choosing, analyzing, and digesting the content of others, then there must be some difference between doing those things, analyzing, digesting, selecting, displaying the content of others, and creating your own information content, which is what YouTube could get in trouble for, right? They can get in trouble for their own information content. If YouTube creates their own video and posts their own video that says, yay, ISIS, donate to ISIS, well, then YouTube is in trouble and they're toast. But if all they do is digest, analyze, and display somebody else's video to that effect, then the argument would go, they're protected. And he said that distinction between digesting and analyzing versus creating content only applies to this tiny little piece of the definition of an information content provider. I don't think anyone was buying that. It's a hyper-technical question, but for those sort of Section 230 geeks out there, it was a debate about whether subsection F4 apply to all of 230 or part of 230 because, you know, you provided access software, and access software providers are a subset of information content providers. It was an interesting discussion. I think the counsel for Gonzalez was wrong about the distinction he's drawing, but there you have it. So the next advocate was Malcolm Stewart for the United States. I thought he did a pretty good job, even though I don't agree with his outcome. I thought he did. He was at least talking about the right parts of the statute, which was comforting. He drew this distinction between whether or not you're being held liable for the content, information content of others, third-party information content, versus being held liable for your own choices or for your own content. And I thought that was useful and interesting. It's just, in this particular case, I don't think it applies. But I think it was a useful line to draw, and it's a good way of thinking about 230 going forward. So I fully agree that 230 does not immunize you for information content that you, the service provider, provides. So if YouTube makes their own video, they're screwed. If YouTube, personally, I think, if YouTube adopts and endorses your video, affirmatively says, yes, that's true, we like that, and we agree, and you should watch this because that's true, well, that's like adopting a libel. It's one thing to say I'm not going to hold them responsible just because they reposted your libel. It's another thing to say I'm holding them liable for endorsing it. You know, just because you repeat somebody's libel and then endorse it doesn't mean you're immunized. And I think that's about right. What I don't agree with him is that here, the YouTube's conduct is what to display, what to prioritize. But the prioritization decision is not based on endorsement. It's based on unrelated criteria like you seem to like ISIS, or you seem to like cats, or you seem to watch a lot of these and we'd like to keep you on our channel longer, so here's another one. All of those things are not endorsement, even though they're choices, but those choices are not the kind of choices that amount to the harm that they're talking about, material support, for example, or aiding and abetting. So it's where I sort of separate from what the government's position, but I'm happy that the government is indeed focusing on the key words of, are you being held liable for the information content of someone else? Here, of course, the harm being alleged is precisely because somebody watched an ISIS video. They're mad because someone watched an ISIS video, agreed with ISIS, and therefore supported them. That is exactly what they're trying to hold YouTube liable for, is that YouTube just made it possible for more people to watch ISIS videos, and those ISIS videos led to bad results. And the whole point of 230 is to make it possible to watch other people's videos without being held liable for other people's videos. So I don't think the government has the result right, but I think at least the analysis they were engaging in was correct. And I thought the good example that they and others gave was, look, if you have an algorithm that discriminates on the basis of race and says, I refuse to show houses in a certain neighborhood to black people because that's a white neighborhood, and I refuse to let black people into that neighborhood. And you write your algorithm to say, don't let any black people see housing listings in this neighborhood. Well, you're being held liable for your discriminatory algorithm, not for the content of the housing post. The housing post isn't what's offensive. It's your choice not to let them see it, that independently of the underlying content is discriminatory, right? That you are, in fact, discriminating on the basis of race because you made an affirmative decision that you didn't want black people in the neighborhood. It has nothing to do with the underlying post, other than it happened to be about housing. But it's not like the post is what caused them harm. It's your choices. So I thought that was an excellent distinction between being held liable for third-party content versus being held liable for your own behavior. And I think it's a distinction that most people agreed with. I thought the justices questioning it all seemed to agree with. I thought even Lisa Blatt for Google agreed with it. Turning to Lisa Blatt, I thought she did a fine job. She had a little pushback, but not anywhere near as much as counsel for Gonzalez did. And I thought her opening basically sort of said it all. Are you being held liable for something where the harms flow from the underlying content that wasn't yours? And here the answer is yes, the harms flow from watching someone else's video. They're trying to hold YouTube liable for that, and they shouldn't be able to. Now, and she sort of agrees that there's a continuum between merely posting someone else's video without any intervention at all, just first come, first serve, whatever is the next video posted goes up on the screen, versus endorsing and recommending something, because you say everyone should watch ISIS because ISIS is the bomb. Bad pun, obviously, but because ISIS is the best group ever and we're going to have you watch them. That there's a big continuum where I think she suggests that she agrees that that last one, if you say ISIS is great, watch an ISIS video, you're endorsing them, you're adopting them. And so you can indeed be held liable because now you're being held liable for your own content. It's not merely third-party content anymore. You've adopted it, endorsed it, and made it your own. Versus all you really did is say, I'm just feeding you more of what you want. I don't give a shit what the what is. I don't care what the underlying content is. I'm not endorsing it. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just giving you what you have, what seems to fit for you. And I like that way of thinking about it. And here, of course, she said that the prioritization of Google, of YouTube's algorithm, has nothing to do with whether YouTube agrees or disagrees with ISIS videos. It has everything to do with who you, the user, are, and whether predictively they think this is something that you were asking for, something that you would want, something that you would like. So that was ultimately good. She got a little bit of pushback from Justice Jackson, sort of wondering whether this goes beyond the original intended scope of Section 230. I think she did a nice job of pointing out that that view of the original scope is incorrect. It was never intended. It was certainly in response to that scenario, but it was never intended to be limited to that scenario. And I thought she did a nice job of pointing out that the purposes of 230, as described in the holdings and findings and purpose section of the statute, make it clear that it was broader than that. So there you have it. I liked the argument. I thought it was interesting. I was encouraged that both the justices, the United States, and Lisa Blatt for Google were focusing on the parts of the statute that I, at least personally, think are most important. Now, so the last question, the last interesting thing for free speech folks is, so First Amendment, free speech, where did that come in here? And the place I see the underlying lurking issues again turns on this notion of content of others versus content of yours. And this issue will come up again once we get to the Texas and Florida statutes trying to stop viewpoint discrimination, for example, and use that as a way of getting you out of 230. And I sort of think that, look, the most protected First Amendment behavior you can imagine, literally making your own video and posting it on YouTube. So say YouTube, as an editorial board, says, we're going to post a video that says, you know, go Joe Biden or go Ron DeSantis or, you know, yay ISIS. So whatever they want to say, or boo ISIS for that matter, that is all very self-evidently First Amendment protected speech. But of course, is not protected by Section 230, because Section 230 only protects you from liability for the content of other people, not for your own content. So on the one extreme, highest course First Amendment behavior, not covered by 230. On the other extreme, if you did nothing but just sort of made it a public access channel with no prioritization and no editorial discretion and nothing, it was simply, you post it, it goes up, we don't help people screen for beans, we don't help you with anything. That clearly gets Section 230 protection because that's entirely the content of others. You're not recommending anything. No one imagines that you can be held liable for that. So what do you do about in the middle where you are engaging in some sort of editorial function, whether it's editing for what we think is best suited to our readers, editing for what you like the most, editing for what you think is most interesting in that day, or even editing for viewpoint? What if I run conservatives only YouTube, and so I screen out all Democratic videos and I only run conservative videos, or vice versa? That's plainly viewpoint discrimination, yet it's editorial, yet I'm not necessarily adopting and endorsing the views being stated. I'm just limiting the content, almost like a limited public forum. And for me, I think that's the interesting category where it is both protected by the First Amendment and it is protected by 230. That 230 protects more than simply passive behavior. It protects editorial choice that would also be protected by the First Amendment, even while it does not protect your own personal speech, which is protected by the First Amendment. So for those of you here, because you like the First Amendment, those are the interesting questions that underlie this, and the interesting questions about where to draw a line and how to think about not just this case, but the cases that are inevitably coming up between the Florida and Texas statutes that are both up on cert petitions now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.